From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributor to the National Journal, Jonathan Broder, contributor to the Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Coronavirus continues to spread to countries around the world as political leaders and health officials grapple with ways to contain the spread of the virus and to minimize the impact that the pandemic is having on the daily lives of their citizens. In the U.S., the first known case of the virus was detected as the Trump administration scrambled to implement policies and procedures to combat the spread of the virus, while facing criticism that the president might be more concerned with controlling the messaging than he is about controlling the virus itself. The race for the White House kicks into high gear as voters go to the polls in South Carolina and a number of other key states over the next few days. The results will almost certainly narrow what is still, for now, a very large field of candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination. And we take a look at the city of Idlib, where yet another humanitarian crisis looms in war-ravaged Syria. Gentlemen, welcome to Issues in the News. Let's start off with the world situation with the coronavirus, with an outbreak that centered originally around China. We now see cases that are apparent in, I believe, some 54 countries, I think, at the last count as of this morning. We have, of course, mainland China, Hong Kong, Macau, but we have South Korea, Italy, Iran, France, some 83,000 detected cases, almost 3,000 deaths from the virus. China being the epicenter of the outbreak, Jonathan, I'll start with you. Is the outbreak under control there? Are we still seeing that raging panic that we had with the virus, or is it becoming more of a controlled situation?
What we're seeing is what the Chinese government is saying is that it appears to have peaked, and they've taken extraordinary measures. They've quarantined basically all of Hubei province, which is 60 million people. I mean, that's the equivalent of quarantining the entire population of Italy.
It's just a stunning number when you talk about the population of China.
Exactly. Yeah. And what it shows is two things. I mean, the authoritarian government in China is very hierarchical, and the provincial leaders must get permission from Beijing before they can take any action.
Yes.
So that was the cause of the delay in the beginning of the outbreak in terms of addressing this. I heard from a source of mine, in fact, the Chinese leadership knew about this, or at least in Hubei province, back in November this was showing up. But what happened was that the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese army, was scheduled to have an Olympiad, like sports games, in Wuhan in November, and this is very important to the leadership in Beijing. So the party leaders in Wuhan didn't tell Beijing about this so that the games would go forth. So that complicated things. On the other hand, because of the authoritarian government, they have the ability to monitor and control the situation in a way that free societies don't.
And again, so it's this combination or sort of this juxtaposition of things within the Chinese government about, as you say, the control and then the control of the messaging, control of the virus, and we'll get to that in the U.S. in later talks. Tom?
Well, the one nation that nobody's talking about is North Korea. We all know that China is, in fact, the epicenter, and South Korea has got thousands of cases, tens of thousands of cases, and hundreds of deaths. We don't hear anything about North Korea. You have to assume there are tens of thousands of possible cases and likely deaths there. The other thing I think that is worrisome, it's at least in one instance in the United States, someone has come down with the virus, and this is not an individual who flew in from Asia or got off a cruise ship or someone who just seemed to have gotten it in a way that nobody knows. And so I think there's a lot of underreporting. I'm not talking about media underreporting. I think there's a lot of underreporting on the part of government officials, except when you get a situation like Italy that you can't ignore it any longer. I guess I always think situations like this will get a lot worse before they get better. The question is how long before they get better, and how much better is better when we get there. And those are what Donald Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense, used to call unknown unknowns.
Yeah.
But it does not look good. And in this country, of course, the U.S. stock market is completely rattled. In less than a week, it has lost almost all the gains from the Trump economy in the last 3 years. I'm sure we'll talk more about that in a moment.
Indeed, we will. We've dealt with other outbreaks. We've dealt in recent years with Ebola. We've dealt with Zika virus. It seems as though every 4 years sort of we get one of these things. I mean, it just seems that way to me. But this feels a little bit different than those. Scientifically, and I know there's no scientists sitting around the table, but we have some very educated and informed people. Are scientists saying that this is somehow different, that it's more like that disease X that's the fear of every scientist in every country, every person, really, that one that carries around the world and is uncurable and ravages populations?
Probably the most unsettling aspect of the coronavirus is that we don't know. We actually don't know. And the scientists will be the first people to tell you
that. We're still learning about this.
Exactly. And one of the big problems with the U.S. response inside the United States is the lack of preparedness in the administration. Since Trump took office, he has gutted funding and personnel for the CDC, for the folks on the National Security Council.
There was an office that was actually set up
to
manage and control pandemics,
specifically
this thing that was disbanded by the Trump administration.
Exactly.
A number of people have pointed to that.
Right. And now what Trump is trying to do is bring people, or frantically trying to bring people back. And as many have pointed out, it's not so easy. I mean, people who leave government service, they get jobs at universities, they have 401ks, they've gone on with their lives. It's not so easy for them to leave those jobs and come back into government service. So Trump is claiming that it's very, very easy to get these people back. It's not easy at all.
Let's pivot to the U.S., and we have the administration that is somewhat concerned about its preparedness. There's a lot of concern both within the administration and within Congress. Let's shift to Congress for a moment. Is Congress appropriating the money that's necessary? This is not being politicized, is it?
No, in that respect, it's not being politicized. Congress will appropriate. The administration has asked for $2.5 billion, but they will ask for more. And it's been clear on Capitol Hill that they'll get whatever the White House wants, they will get on this, because it has been politicized to the extent that some Democrats have been saying what we've already discussed here, that entities of the government were shut down by the Trump administration, funding for the Centers for Disease Control and others. All of that has happened. But for the most part, the money will be there because the money has to be there. That is for sure.
And to talk about the press conference, I want to move to the press conference that the president
had. An extraordinary press conference. I can't resist saying this is the second time in 3 years that President Trump has been in that briefing room twice. And I should also say, I think that's two times as many times as his press secretary has been there. But I knew when he came out and talked about, well, I was just astounded to learn that 20,000 or 25,000 Americans die of the flu every year. I knew he was trying to say it could be a lot worse. He basically the president was trying to say, we're doing very well. It's under control. We're going to be fine. And at one point, he said something that I know made some of his aides wince. He basically said, and this is a paraphrase, like a miracle, at some point this will be over. It'll just go away. He's also said, when the warmer weather comes in April, the virus will die out. But the truth is, we don't know. I mean, I guess I'm old enough to have remembered that in the Ford administration, between 1974 and 1976, there was a fears among the medical experts that there was going to be a huge outbreak of swine flu in the United States. And President Ford had to fight off some of his aides who said, we can't waste this kind of money. They spent tens of millions of dollars inoculating almost everyone in the country against swine flu, worried that there would be a huge epidemic. Well, it didn't happen. But even today, people who worked for Ford at that time said we did the prudent thing. So the question is, this government has belatedly learned that you got to do the prudent thing, because anybody who thinks that the epidemic has been nipped in the bud in the United States is dreaming.
I want to turn to you, John, that you have the president being sort of an optimist, let's say, if he wants to display a certain type of optimism and hopefulness about it. And I think that that's what his supporters of the president and those around him would say, that he's being an optimist, and that's part of his job, is to be an optimist. But I've heard other officials call out the difference between optimism and what some officials call happy talk, which is trying to happy talk and put a brave face on something that requires solutions and not, let's say, you know, nice words about it, that this is all going to go away. As Tom said, I think this may be the most challenging thing for this president, and the fact of making science and having to be face a situation where credibility is the most important tool in the toolbox, maybe, for the government, along with expertise. How do you frame this challenge for the administration?
The challenge for the administration is the conflict and the tension between science and politics.
Yeah.
Trump has based his reelection campaign largely on the strength of the economy. And, of course, he always points to the stock market. Stock market, as Tom said, is in free fall right now. It's unclear whether we have a medical disease pandemic, but we surely have an economic pandemic. And this is weakening Trump, or at least in his own eyes, it's weakening him. You said happy talk. I would say something else. I would say that Trump is basically spreading disinformation and misinformation, totally wrong facts. I mean, he got up there at that news conference and he said that a vaccine is just around the corner. That's not true. I mean, his own scientific experts that were surrounding him at that news conference contradicted him immediately and said, no, it's going to take months.
A year and a half.
Yes.
A year and a half.
I mean, you got to go through testing and all that kind of thing. The one thing that's missing in this entire discussion is information. We don't have information, and the stock market thrives on certainty. Businesses thrive on
certainty.
Absolutely.
Confidence.
And all there is a lack of information, which is why people are selling off their stocks.
Yeah, it is a lack of confidence. That's what markets respond to most certainly. I'm going to finish with you, Tom. And when we talk about confidence, and you have a situation where the epidemic started in China, or pandemic started in China, which is not necessarily known for truth and openness, and you have this, the Trump administration now in the U.S. that has certainly had some challenges with scientific truth to the public. Where do we go for the truth? Where does confidence come from in this situation?
Well, it probably come from the World Health Organization, which is not held in high regard by the current Trump administration, and from the Centers for Disease Control. I mean, the CDC guys, men and women, are the pros at this. But they are CDC. They've been told that they really can't talk about this without getting a permission from the new task force headed by Vice President Mike Pence. So I think the problem for the administration is, one, a lot of people are skeptical about the information they're getting or not getting. I'll say one thing very quickly, Michael, on that is there's one thing you don't hear President Trump saying these days, and it's something he loves to say. He loves to say, have you looked at your 401ks lately? 401k being an extremely popular retirement savings vehicle that hundreds of millions of Americans have. And over the last 3 years, the value of their 401ks has been in the stratosphere. He's not saying that anymore because, as I said, earlier, in a blink of the eye, the last week, a third of the gains since President Trump's reelection in the stock market have just vaporized overnight. I mean, in this country, people say, we don't like the stock market going down 2, 3, 4% in a day, but it's a good time to jump in and buy. It's called buying on the dips. Well, every time people have done that this week, there's not a dip. There's another downward drift. I have to say, the other day, I thought Trump would come out and calm things down, and the next day the market would go up. So I bought a very small amount of stock, which in the 3 days I've held it is now down 2%. And I suspect the Wall Street guys have done that with billions of dollars, and they're probably really hurting.
No, it's definitely a situation where the markets are in a very difficult situation. And again, managing the message and managing the disease and the outbreak is really sort of the balancing act that governments across the world will have to do. We'll take a break right here, and we'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tom DeFrank, contributor to the National Journal. Jonathan Broder, contributing editor to the Congressional Quarterly. And moderator Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Let's turn to the Democratic presidential race. Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden, who is running for President of the United States, at the last Democratic presidential debate declared confidently that he would be the winner in South Carolina, the first southern state to vote in the primary elections. Certain polls have Biden still as the leader with about 30%, followed by Bernie Sanders with about 23%. And Tom Steyer, a wealthy businessman who has spent a lot of money up until now in South Carolina, polling third at 13%. This is a huge challenge for Joe Biden. It's meant to be his quote-unquote firewall against what's been sort of a disaster of a primary season so far. But I think for a number of candidates, this is going to be a make-or-break week/weekend. I'm going to start with the debates, Jonathan. They were messy at best. Did these messy, contentious debates help anyone or hurt everyone on the stage?
I think that the winner of those debates was Donald Trump.
Yep.
At least before the coronavirus took over the news cycle. It showed a lot of dissension within the Democratic Party between moderates and progressives. Everybody was attacking each other.
Yeah.
It was very fractious. Actually, I couldn't watch it any longer. I watched and watched, and then it became so much shouting and people shouting over one another that I just turned it off. I couldn't listen anymore.
It was difficult as a viewer to get any information as people struggled to try to make one last impression before what is inarguably a critical election on Saturday. Again, we talk about Joe Biden. It is a make or break for him. He feels so. The leadership feels so. I assume you agree with that assessment.
It was make or break for Biden, and that's why I think he was far more aggressive, far more effective. When the moderators tried to say, your time is up, he said, I'm going to finish what I have to say. He was aggressive, he was assertive, and I think he helped himself. But it was a food fight from start to finish and not a very edifying one. But the bottom line remains, there's really going to be three people with a chance of getting the Democratic nomination. One is Senator Bernie Sanders, the overwhelming leader at the moment. Another is Vice President Biden, and the other is former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. It's going to be one of those three. And it remains to be seen whether anyone will go to the convention in Milwaukee with enough delegates to have wrapped it up. And the question then would become, what happens to the so-called superdelegates? These are people who, by and large, state and local, national Democratic officials who can weigh in. It's going to be messy. The biggest question is, will this fractious party, which is always fractious, is it going to come together under what they believe is the common good, which is the Democrats are desperate to find somebody who can beat President Trump. And the only way that will happen is that if the losers get together and say, we're going to band together and support the Democratic nominee, even if we have to hold our nose, because whoever that is will be better than President Trump. And that's a tall order.
Yeah, we've had a lot of the candidates say that they will, in fact, support whoever is the eventual nominee. But that is after a lot of arrows have been thrown in various directions at these same candidates.
Exactly. Tom Friedman, a columnist for The New York Times, had a very, very interesting column this past week in which he called for a sort of a unity government among the Democrats, which is something that has really never been done before. What he basically said was, if you take all of the candidates that are in the field, he's saying that whoever is the nominee should take these rivals for the nomination and bring them into his cabinet. Make Elizabeth Warren the Secretary for Health and Human Services. Make William McRaven, who's not running for office, but he used to be the head of Special Forces and led the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, make him the Defense Secretary. Make Joe Biden, if he doesn't get the nomination, make him the Secretary of State. Nobody knows world leaders like Joe Biden does.
Right.
And so on.
And make Michael Bloomberg the Secretary of the Treasury, which is something that I think would,
yes,
would appeal to Bloomberg's ego.
Exactly.
And he'd probably be pretty good at it.
Right.
That is a very interesting prospect to say, what can these people do? But you'd have to run on that and declare from the beginning, you know, running on these people and now have to carry their baggage along with you for the entire election. So like Ebenezer Scrooge's chains, you know, behind him. When we go back to specific candidates and talk about them in terms of the lanes that they're in, if you add up, say, the progressives, which Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren represent, against the centrists, which the rest of the candidates basically represent, still the centrists are leading the progressives. We have to get to the point at some point where you have one centrist and one progressive. Who do you think those will be? There will be two candidates probably still viable after Super Tuesday.
I think Tom had it right. I think the candidates will be either Bloomberg or Biden as the centrist and Bernie Sanders.
Do you think Bloomberg, because of the money to stay in it all the way, will stay in it all the way, despite the numbers, because he has the money to stay in this?
I think he will, but he's also said that he's committed to spending hundreds of millions, maybe even a few billion in the fall, to elect Democratic senators and Democratic and reelect Democratic House members. That he, to that extent, he's in it all the way. And that, I think, is what worries President Trump the most, because Trump understands the money and the power of money. Trump's campaign has put together a massive money-raising machine. So Trump understands and respects the power of money and in political campaigns, and Bloomberg has more by himself probably than the entire very wealthy Trump-Pence campaign.
Yeah, he's definitely got the deep pockets.
I heard one wonderful thing. I guess I read it on Twitter. I can't remember who said this, but the suggestion was that Bloomberg should buy all of Trump's debt to the Deutsche Bank and then call it in and take everything, which I thought was a marvelous idea.
Machiavelli rears its ugly head. That is an interesting one.
Right.
You raised the prospect of sort of this Unitarian government, sort of a grand plan for unity, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And in days of old, that would have been possible because there was something called the Democratic Party. There was something called the Democratic National Committee, where you had party leaders, party heads, who would sit a group of people down and say, here's what's going to happen. Or as Joe Biden loves to say, here's the deal. Where does that exist anymore? Is there any actual leadership within the Democratic Party structure? Is there anyone who can direct and guide and even demand compliance from some of these candidates as we move forward?
Yes, I think Speaker Nancy Pelosi, I think a couple of other people that our foreign listeners have never heard of, some retired Democratic National Committee officials. There is a infrastructure there, but the problem is you don't want to be in a situation where it looks like there's a smoke-filled room deciding a result that may not be popular with a large number of Democrats. As I said earlier, the real danger is that Bernie Sanders comes into the convention in Milwaukee with a huge lead, but not enough delegates to get the nomination. And if that happens, then I think he's not going to get the nomination. I mean, he's either got to have it going in or he's not going to get it. And then the progressives might say, we've been had by the party, and they might bolt.
I mean, bolt or stay home.
A Republican I know very well said just 3 or 4 days ago that if Sanders doesn't get the nomination, he and his acolytes, he and his supporters, will bolt and they'll form a Green Party. They'll take 4% of the vote, and that'll be enough to get Trump reelected. It goes back to the unity thing. If the Democrats are grown-ups, they have a good chance to defeat President Trump. If they're not grown-ups, then he's going to be here for another 4 years.
You might be asking a lot with that grown-up thing. But we'll see what happens. Very quickly, as we close, I want to take a couple of minutes to discuss the crisis in Idlib and what seems like a repeat of the disaster in nearby Aleppo. The city of Idlib is under siege as Syrian and Russian forces bombard civilian targets and engage in daily clashes with Turkish forces in the area. Secretary General of NATO Jens Stoltenberg said he just met with our ally Turkey following the death of Turkish soldiers near Idlib. I think it was 33 soldiers who were killed. We condemn the indiscriminate airstrikes by the Syrian regime and Russia. This dangerous situation must be de-escalated and humanitarian access allowed. Did start with you, Tom. Where's NATO on this? Where's the U.S. on this?
I think they're on the sidelines. Basically, Russia is calling the shots in this area of the world. I mean, we have basically more or less dialed out of Syria. The president's made it clear he wants to be out of there. We're not totally out of there. The Russians, now the lead player, for good or ill, and I think it's ill, in that dangerous piece of the world.
Jonathan, I'll give you the last word on this one. I'll ask you the same question. Where is the U.S. on this? Where is Mike Pompeo? Where is a statement on at least the prospect of humanitarian help, maybe a safe zone to help get some of those refugees out of there? Further questions, what would a new wave of Syrian refugees do to world politics?
That's a good question. I'll address that first. As a result of this airstrike, and we don't know who carried it out, the Russians say they didn't do it, so it may have been the Syrians. These 33 Turkish soldiers were killed. And that's putting a lot of pressure on President Erdogan to respond. He's going to have to show some fists here. What he's warning is that he is going to open the floodgates and start allowing the refugees that he's been harboring, there's 3 million Syrian refugees inside Turkey, allow them to go to Europe. This at a time when the coronavirus is spreading in Europe. So it's a confluence of very dangerous trends.
I think, with the trends that we've seen before and that last wave of Syrian refugees, what that did to geopolitics,
right.
We could expect to see even a greater reaction.
One last point I'll make is that if Russia gets sucked into the Turkish response, there's an assumption that because it's a NATO member of NATO that the United States would have to step in. That's not the case. The Article 5, which commits all for one, one for all,
yeah.
only applies when it's on the territory of that country. And right now, there hasn't been a Syrian or Russian attacks inside Turkey.
Great point, as always. We're going to have to stop there, though. That is all the time we have. Thanks to our panel, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at The National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.